rage that seems to have no object. Mr. McQueen, just how stupid are you? McQueen spits the words out. Can't you tell a fucking ambush when you see one? The colonel rests his hand free, but he doesn't touch the keypad. Go on, he says quietly. McQueen grimaces and shakes his head, but he gets it out with a sort of grim disgust, like a man spitting blood and disinfectant into a bucket after getting dental work done. They brought you here so they could kill you and take Rosie. That's the only reason they told Fournier to pass the radio on to you, so they could get you out here in the middle of nowhere and take you out of the equation. What the hell are you talking about? Foss demands. She laughs, and she looks to the colonel as though she expects him to laugh, too. Dr. Fournier didn't give me the radio, Carlyle reminds McQueen. You did. McQueen raises his hands in sardonic surrender. Shit! I'm not saying I'm not involved. Can we stick to the point? Fry wants you gone, and the whole idea of meeting up out here instead of back in Beacon is to make that happen. No fuss, no reporting. You just don't come home. Carlyle feels a dull certainty settling on him, but he fights against it. Why should it matter if I come home or not? I have no authority in Beacon. I'm no threat to the Brigadier. Yeah, well, you might be now. While we were away, she decided to take over the main table, but they're fighting back. She had bad losses, so she had to reach out and make a deal. With the Junkers. Those are Junker battle trucks out there. Now she's worried you might pitch in on the opposite side. Plus, she needs Rosie because of the guns and armour, and she doesn't think you're likely to just hand over the keys. Foss hasn't said another word all this time. She's just been looking at McQueen. Now she slings her rifle to free her hands, moving briskly but carefully, and punches him in the mouth. It's a solid punch. It rocks McQueen on his heels a little. He takes it in silence, just wipes the blood off his lip and probes the damage with the tip of his thumb. "You stupid, stupid bastard!" Foss yells. "Okay," McQueen mutters. "Fine."
Junkers! A deal with the Junkers? What, with their recreational rape and their fucking cannibalism and... Shit! Shit!
Get it all off your chest, McQueen says bleakly, rolling his eyes.
What did you think was going to happen to the rest of us after they killed the Colonel? You really expect them to fly us out of here in a gunship? Cocktails and fluffy pillows? He didn't walk into an ambush. You did. We're toast when we go out there, you utter fucking moron.
She raises clenched fists. Another punch seems imminent. McQueen looks away from her overflowing anger, out into the opaque night. Lieutenant, Carlyle says. His mild tone works. Foss gets a grip, though she is still trembling with suppressed fury. Carlyle has seen her copy McQueen's mannerisms in the field, the swagger in his walk, the way he uses the heel of his hand to take the safety off the scar H when he's obliged to use one. Her disillusionment is a free-fall plunge. "Set aside your differences," he says to both of them. "Now, please. I'm inclined to agree with Foss's assessment. If killing me is the main agenda, it's hard to imagine that the killing will end there. Especially if we're witness to an illegal alliance with Beacon's enemies. We need to keep Rosie from falling into unauthorized hands, and we need to protect the science team. In addition, and this is more important than anything, we need to make sure that the news of what we've discovered gets back to Beacon. We can't do any of those things unless we're all fighting on the same side." It's not eloquent, but it's the best he can do. The measured words sound pusillanimous even to him, but the alternative is to stand here trading punches while Fry surrounds them. "So what's it to be, numbnuts?" Foss snarls the words into McQueen's face. There is a long, strained pause. At last McQueen shrugs. "I don't care whether you live or die," he tells Carlyle. On the whole, I'd prefer to watch you bleed. If Beacon falls apart, it's because you stood by and let it, when you could have turned it into something better. But I'll admit I didn't think this through. I'm with you until we sort this and get out of here. Foss draws her sidearm and shoves it up against McQueen's cheek. For all her fury, her hand doesn't shake. Just so you know, she says, if anyone bleeds, it's going to be you. Sir, what are your orders? First things first, Carlyle decides. Man the turret guns, Lieutenant. If we're attacked, we'll need to be in a position to return fire. He turns to go back into the cockpit. Sixsmith is right behind him, holding up Fournier's radio. Colonel, she says, we're being hailed. By Captain Manolis? No, sir, by Brigadier Fry. She's somewhere out there, and she wants to talk to you. Chapter 56. It's not like the other times. It's a lot worse. Dr. Khan's eyes are rolling back into her head, showing pure white for seconds at a time. Her movements are violent and uncoordinated. Several times on the short journey from the crew quarters to the lab, she almost falls. As Greaves tries to mix the serum, she is scrabbling at his arm, clutching blindly at his head. She has made no attempt to bite him, but there is an urgency to her movements, almost a desperation. A sense of need is waking up inside her, moving her. It can only be a matter of minutes, Greaves thinks, maybe seconds, before the cordyceps in her blood and brain is able to make her do what it wants. Babbling apologies in an endless stream, he attempts to strap Dr. Khan to the workbench. When the bench was installed, the vivisection of Hungries without anaesthetic was unflinchingly taken into account and catered for. It's easy to loop and tighten the first strap around Rena's left wrist. After that, she fights harder, kicking and clawing at him. Her jaws are starting to work, opening and closing with a grating click of cartilage. In the end, he has to leave her with just the one arm restrained. "It will be okay," he promises her. I'll make up the dose. Don't worry. Don't worry. Tears blind him as he works. This is the last batch of serum. This is goodbye. Each dose has worked for a shorter period than the one before it, and this one is the dregs of the batch, smaller than the preceding doses and, of course, not so fresh. It might not work at all. He might have left it too late. And if it does work, it will be for a few scant hours. After that, Rena will go away, forever, and all that will be left will be an animal that wears her face. What will he do without her? What will he do with what remains of her? And what will happen to her baby? When he approaches Rena with the needle, she snaps and snarls at him. Drool flecks her lips, which have receded a long way from her bared teeth. There is no recognition in her wide eyes. Greaves grabs her free arm and rolls up her sleeve, using his shoulder and the weight of his body to force her head back against the bench. He can feel Rena's jaws opening and closing against his upper arm, but there are several thicknesses of fabric there, and he doesn't think she will have time to chew her way through. She is struggling furiously. He stabs the needle into her arm, but misses the cubital vein by a fraction of an inch. The second time, he's not even close. The third time, with Rena's teeth grinding against his shoulder, he gets a bullseye and sinks the plunger in. Cloth tears as he pulls himself free from her. A tiny shred of fabric stays between her clenched teeth, like the seat of a burglar's trousers in the dog's jaws in an ancient comic book he saw once at the orphanage. She spits it out, and strains to get to him, to try for another bite. He is forced to retreat around the bench out of her reach. He waits to see if she will recognize him. He's crying again, wrenching sobs that shake and hurt him as they're expelled. Every few seconds he says her name aloud in the hope that she will answer. She doesn't. But her breathing calms and gradually she closes her mouth. She sinks down onto her knees, her legs bending under her, and sags a little, although her bound wrist keeps her more or less upright. The blank look goes out of her eyes. Now she just looks exhausted and confused, her brows furrowed with thought as she stares around the lab. She blinks slowly, screwing her eyes closed for several seconds, before opening them again and taking a second look, as though she hopes a second throw of the dice might have a better outcome.
Rena? Stephen says again.
Again she doesn't speak, but when he holds out his hand to her, she touches his palm with the tip of one finger. He gives a tearful laugh, returning the one-finger hug. Rena turns her head, her eyelids flickering a little as she stares at the strap around her wrist. She tugs against it to see if it will give, fumbles at it with the fingers of her free hand.
"I'm sorry. I'm sorry," Stephen says thickly. "I had to. I'm sorry."
He steps forward quickly to untie her. But he doesn't get there. Dr. Fournier steps out of the dark of the engine room, whose door has been open all this time, and blocks his way. It's so sudden that Stephen jumps backward and slams his elbow painfully on the corner of the freezer cabinet. He yelps and folds his arms around the pane. "Don't touch her," Dr. Fournier snaps. And then, "What did you do, Greaves? Tell me what you did." "My God, she's infected. She's infected and you found a way to control it. You found a cure."
"No,"
Stephen says. It's completely involuntary. Presented with the false statement, he has no choice but to correct it. "I know what I saw. Tell me. Tell me how you did this."
"I can't," Stephen yelps. "Please."
In the intensity of his feeling, Dr. Fournier grabs Stephen's shoulders and pushes him back against the freezer cabinet. "Tell me," he roars. The shock of physical contact freezes Stephen on the spot. He doesn't even struggle. Words well up behind his teeth start to spill out.
"It's cerebrospinal fluid of the captured hungry. You take a base mass of between 20 and 50 cc and fix with..."
There is a sound like the dull ringing of a gong. Dr. Fournier grunts, stiffens, and falls headlong, unconscious, before he hits the deck plates. Rena lets the steel clamp stand slide from between her fingers. It hits the doctor again when it falls, leaving a triangular gash on his cheek. Rena's eyes roll wide and wild. She blinks and shakes her head, makes a brrr sound. "That's better," she growls through clenched teeth. "Hear myself think." Chapter 57. "This is Carlyle to Brigadier Fry," the colonel says. "Carlyle to Fry, or to the Beacon Muster. Over." He has turned the radio's gain up as far as it will go, and most of the remaining members of Rosie's military escort are crowded into the cockpit with him. Only Foss is missing, manning the turret again to warn him if the other vehicles out on the tarmac make a move. The response is a long time in coming, and the Brigadier sounds very relaxed when she finally answers the Colonel's hail. "Isaac, welcome to Base Hotel Echo. Did you have any trouble finding us?" Carlyle isn't tempted by the invitation to small talk. "Brigadier," he says, "we identify hostiles in the immediate area. I request leave to pursue our original course and rendezvous at Beacon. This place isn't safe." "Request denied," Fry says in the same calm tone. "Those aren't hostiles, they're allies. Now, bearing in mind my explicit instructions to you yesterday, please open your doors and assemble on the tarmac. My troops will take Rosie from here, along with the specimen you mentioned, assuming it actually exists, and you'll be transferred to Beacon." And here they are, at the point where polite pretense has to break down. "Transferred how?" Carlyle says, We see Junker battle trucks and Junker carders on the ground. I'm not convinced you can guarantee our safety.
I can guarantee your safety if you come out immediately,
not if you continue to waste my time. The Brigadier sounds just a little testy now, as though she's trying hard to avoid unpleasantness, but is reluctantly acknowledging that it may become necessary after all. We'll drive back together right now. Your orders stand, Isaac. Please come out. At the brink of direct insubordination, Carlyle feels the familiar reluctance to press forward. Instead, he marches in place. Geraldine, you're making common cause with murderers and rapists, who oppose everything we believe in. I refuse to endorse that decision. Let me take Rosie back to Beacon, and we'll perform the handover there in due course.
That's not possible, Fry says bluntly.
Isaac, let me explain the situation to you. There is no room here for argument or negotiation. The alliances I've made are absolutely necessary to ensure Beacon's survival. I'm not offering you any kind of an explanation or any apology. I'm your senior officer, and you will obey me. I'm requisitioning your vehicle for the Beacon muster, right here, right now. If you fail to surrender it, you, along with all your crew, will be guilty of mutiny and treason, and you will be treated accordingly, as enemies of the muster and the polity.
She's bluffing, McQueen says from behind him. She wants Rosie intact, not in pieces.
Is that Lieutenant McQueen? Fry asks. If so, please tell him to be quiet and observe the chain of command.
And if you share his optimism, Isaac, bear in mind that having Rosie in pieces is preferable to having her and you take the field against us.
Geraldine, Carlyle says, making one last appeal to reason. I haven't lied to you. We have encountered a new type of hungry, and we have obtained a specimen. It's vitally important that we deliver it to Beacon intact.
So you told me, Fry snaps. I have to say that it seems unlikely after 7 months of zero findings. I'm inclined to think that you saw this moment coming and finessed accordingly. But if you're telling the truth, that's all the more reason for you to give up without a fight and let Beacon have the benefit of your success.
Carlyle grimaces. For a second he presses the radio against his chest while he formulates a response.
Yes, he admits at last, I can follow the logic of that argument. I'm prepared to hand over the specimen if we can agree a way to do it. But I can't surrender Rosie. I need to think about the safety of my crew. And in that regard, you should know that we also have a baby in here. Samrina Khan gave birth 2 days ago.
There is the smallest perceptible pause.
Really? Fry says. That's wonderful. Against mission regs, of course, but these things happen. I look forward to wetting the baby's head.
No more arguments, Isaac. You, your people, Rosie, the specimen. You will entrust them all to me, and you will do it right now. You have 5 minutes. Use them wisely. I'll be training a scope on your midsection door. The timer doesn't stop until the door opens, and I see you step out.
Brigadier!
But she has broken contact.
Sir, Foss on the walkie-talkie, her voice quick and urgent, the odds just got worse. Two more vehicles are rolling in behind us with their lights out. Definitely Junker ordnance, barbed wire trim welded on bits of shit all over them. There are some more ground troops, too, moving in on our 3 o'clock and our 9.
So they can't retreat, and they can't advance. If there is an unexcluded middle, he's not seeing it. They're out of options and almost out of time.
Foss, he says, stay where you are and prime the field, Pounder, but don't rotate the turret. That may prompt them to start firing.
He turns to Sixsmith. Bring the remaining members of the science team to the crew quarters, Private, he tells her.
Sixsmith rips off a salute and goes astern to the lab. Carlyle goes to the crew quarters himself to await their arrival.
He glances towards the bunks with a poignant ache of nostalgia. He is wearied to death, and it seems unlikely he will sleep again on this side of the grave.
Sixsmith brings Dr. Khan and Stephen Greaves.
McQueen follows them in. Khan is very much the worse for wear, leaning against Sixsmith until she is able to sink down into a chair. "What about Dr. Fournier?" Carlyle demands. "Sir, he was unconscious. He was..." "I smacked him in the head with a clamp stand," Dr. Khan explains. "He was assaulting Stephen, and I acted without thinking. Sorry." "Don't beat yourself up about it," Sixsmith says. "Seriously." Carlyle has no time to tease out the story and very little interest. He sums up what's happening in as few words as he can manage and explains his own decision. "Brigadier Fry has offered to take all of you back to Beacon," he tells them, "as long as I hand Rosie over to her within the next few minutes. If I believed that offer was sincere, I would already have surrendered. But I don't. I think she intends to kill all of us. Given that her troops seem to consist mainly of junkers, I can't even guarantee that death will be a quick one." "Fucking traitor," Sixsmith says. "Filthy fucking traitor." Nobody else says anything at all. "That being the case," Carlyle goes on, "the choice seems to me to be a clear one. I don't want to hand Rosie over to be used as the closing argument in a coup d'etat. But the only alternative I can see is to make a run for it. The Junker battle trucks are civilian vehicles much lighter than Rosie. It would be possible to ram one of them out of the way and push on past. But we're heavily outnumbered, even just on the basis of the vehicles we can actually see. There could easily be more positioned behind the bunkers, and it's almost certain that the foot soldiers who have moved in on our flanks are carrying RPGs." "Affirmative, sir," Foss says via the squawk box. "I've seen two already. Bazookas or grenade launchers. Heavy duty." "So each of you has to decide," Carlyle concludes, "whether you want to stay on board and make that attempt or get out of here. I'm sorry I have no better options to offer you. If any of you want to leave, I'll mount the airlock and open the midsection door. My belief is that you'll be giving yourself up to torturers and murderers that the Brigadier will be unable to rein in, even if she wishes to. But it's possible that I'm wrong." The slightly stunned silence persists. The soldiers know all this already, of course. It's only Dr. Khan and Greaves who are hearing it for the first time. "I told them about your baby, Samrina," he adds. "That may work in your favour, if you should decide..." "I'm not going out there," Khan says. She wipes her eyes, which are red and swollen, with the heel of her hand. "I'll take my chances with you." "Me too," Sixsmith agrees, and Foss, over the walkie-talkie, says the same. Finally, McQueen shrugs and nods. "I don't see what the hell else we can do," he says. "Stand or run, they're going to blow us to shit. We might as well take a few of the bastards with us." "Some of them are Beacon soldiers," Carlyle reminds him, "like you. Part of their function is to obey even when they don't entirely understand." "That shouldn't be part of anybody's function." Reluctantly, Carlyle nods. "Perhaps not," he concedes. He feels as though he is throwing half his life onto the fire with those two words. Only Stephen Greaves has failed to give an answer. Carlyle knows now what the consequences were of not allowing him a voice the last time they spoke like this. He nods to the boy, then deliberately lowers his gaze to make it easier for Stephen to find the words. "I think going out might be a good idea," Greaves says. "You heard what I said, Stephen. The likelihood is..." "No, I know, I know." Greaves gestures with his hands in an accelerating rhythm, not illustrating anything but building up the momentum to speak. "A lot of people will die, but if we're careful it won't be us, because we'll know they're coming." "Know who is coming?" Sixsmith asks blankly. Stephen acknowledges the question by darting her a glance that lasts about a tenth of a second. "The children," he says. "We can bring them." Chapter 58. Lieutenant Foss extends and mounts the airlock, and they assemble on the midsection platform. Five of them, not the full roster. One of the missing is Dr. Fournier, who is still unconscious. When Khan went back into the lab to check on his status, she took the precaution of propping him up against the workbench and fastening his wrists, both together, to one of the straps. He is breathing shallowly but evenly, and she suspects it might be some time before he wakes, but when he does, she wants to make sure he stays exactly where he is. Because the other two crew members who are staying on board are Stephen, who will close the airlock behind them, and her baby. This could go horribly wrong, she tells Stephen just before they leave. Even if it works, even if they come, we could all end up dead. I'm leaving him with you because I trust you to make sure he's okay. She flails for a second on the frictionless slope of that concept. Don't let them take him, Stephen. Whatever happens, don't let them take him. I won't, he promises her. I'll do what we said. Whatever happens. She touches the back of his hand with her fingertip, presses hard. Keep yourself safe, too, she says, her voice shaking. I love you, Stephen. All he can offer her in answer is a tremulous nod. He tries, and then... Rena. He closes his eyes, folds himself in on the emotion to lock it down. Even ordinary social embarrassments are torture for him, so Khan can't imagine what he's feeling now. She wishes his condition would allow her to take him in her arms and stroke his head. She feels as though she's leaving both her children behind, her whole family. But they can't embrace. They can only say goodbye, and drawing it out will hurt him more. So she leaves, without any more words and without breaching the cordon sanitaire around his frail body. She is full to the brim with pain, and the fact that she will soon be empty is the most painful thing of all. The soldiers are all in the airlock when they get there. Foss is talking to McQueen about bullets. You might get to try out those homemades after all. Just wait until I'm somewhere else, okay? Top-notch, these are, McQueen says. You'll be begging me for the recipe. Oh, I know the recipe. That's what bloody worries me. For all their talk of weaponry, their rifles remain strapped across their backs. Their hands are empty. A word, Colonel, Khan says. She beckons him close. Of course. Carlyle leans down towards her, and she whispers in his ear a few terse sentences. The only gift she can give him, but it's not a small one. When she steps back and he straightens, he stares at her in solemn perplexity. Are you sure? He asks her. Yes, she's sure. But that changes... He doesn't finish the sentence, so Khan doesn't have to disagree. Here, now, it changes nothing. It's just the punchline to a joke she won't be alive to tell. Carlyle looks as though he wants to say more, but at that moment Stephen steps out of the crew quarters into the midsection. He has brought the baby to see her off, and the baby's presence somehow eclipses everything else. Stephen holds the tightly wrapped bundle out, gingerly, uncertainly, his eyes flicking from side to side as he tries to avoid so many closely clustered gazes. Khan wraps the baby's tiny hand in both of hers, and leans down to kiss him on the crown of his head, which is covered in unbelievably fine, downy hair. "Godspeed, Buster," she whispers. "Takes after his dad," Foss says. "Poor little bastard." There seems nothing else to say. The moment is suddenly on them. The colonel taps the keypad. The deck plates shake as the airlock's hydraulics wake up. The doors slide back and the soldiers step out onto the broken concrete. Khan climbs down right behind them, wincing as her feet touch down on the parade ground. Her muscles feel wasted, recoilless. But she lines up with the rest as they stand, spotlit by the multiple rows of headlights, showing their empty hands. Showing their number, too. Brigadier Fry knows that Rosie's full complement stands at 7. She has to be aware as the airlock doors slide closed again at their backs that two crew members have remained inside. This is an invitation to negotiate, not a full surrender. So the decision rests with her. A man steps into the focus of the headlight beams, where he turns at once into a two-dimensional silhouette. He's not a soldier. He wears an ancient T-shirt with an indecipherable slogan, torn and mud-spattered jeans and orange snow boots. He waves to them to advance. Khan takes one last glance back at Rosie, her home through the long months of the mission, and the last one she will ever know. No, almost the last. Her body is a house, too, for something subtle and ineffable that answers to its name. She carries her last home with her, walks it forward across weeds and concrete, into a light that is alive with drifting dust motes. Everything, she thinks. Everything is alive. I wish I'd noticed that before. They walk 100 yards. Another 100. Far enough, says a voice, a woman's voice, Brigadier Fry's. Khan has only met the Brigadier once, on the day of their departure, when she told them in front of a crowd of 70 or 80,000 that the future of Beacon rode with them. The doctor barely recognizes the short, trim figure who steps forward now, in urban camo designed for a bigger frame, in black boots on which hardly any black shows through the accreted dust and mud. The Brigadier looks tired. There is a droop to her mouth that reminds Khan of a line from the play Macbeth. I have supped full with horrors. But who hasn't these days? Fry gestures. Men and women deploy behind them, cutting them off from Rosie. More move in to either side of the Brigadier, rifles raised and aimed. Around 3 dozen, Khan guesses, possibly more. A third of them are in military fatigues and hefting Beacon-issue rifles. The remainder wear anything, carry anything. She can see machetes and handmade bows in among the automatic weapons. Like oil and water, the soldiers and the junkers aren't mixing much. The soldiers seem to be holding specific patches of ground between the strutting junker warriors, standing stock still and watching their new allies warily out of the corners of their eyes. The junkers whoop and catcall, nudge and lean on each other as they hold their rough positions, or shift for a better look at what's going down. One of them throws a stone in Rosie's direction, along with a few obscene words. The soldiers stand rigid and silent. Nobody is even pretending that this is business as usual. Fry's gaze scans the little party, and the corners of her mouth tug down. There are only 5 of you, she says. Where are the others? Still on board, Carlyle says, with the door locked. They're waiting on my orders, Brigadier, whether to surrender Rosie or to scupper her, along with the uniquely valuable specimen we talked about earlier. Fry is only a few yards from Carlyle now. The men on either side of her are tense and watchful. The Colonel will die if he moves his hand towards his sidearm. Probably if he moves at all. Fry seems to find his answer mildly puzzling. To scupper Rosie, she repeats. How would you do that? If we reach an amicable agreement here, you'll never have to find out. Fry smiles. It's a little bleak, a little washed out, but it's there. This is another reason why they're still alive, Khan realizes. The Brigadier has built this moment up in her mind, has promised herself the luxury of a conversation. She wants her moment, and she wants Colonel Carlyle to share it. I have already given you all the assurances I can, Isaac, she says. And really, you have no bargaining power here. You mentioned a baby, yet now I'm expected to believe that you, and the mother, have come up with a plan in which the baby remains behind in Rosie to be blown up, or burned to death if we fail to see eye to eye. I know you better than that. The Colonel lets his gaze sweep across the ragged line of Junker warriors. I imagine we've both moved on from the opinions we expressed the last time we talked, he says. And on, Khan thinks. Go ahead, keep it up. while their invisible signal flare goes out into the night. They washed off their E-blocker before they stepped out of Rosie, every one of them. Even normal hungries can follow very tiny chemical gradients for miles. The feral children have shown themselves more tenacious again, and much more resourceful. Come on, kids. We're right here. So let's party. But the kids don't come, and Khan's mind feels like a febrile flame, drawing up the light and heat from the searing headlights and turning them into something lighter and hotter still. She's going. She knows she is. Her consciousness will sublime away into the air. The dull-eyed animal that's left behind will make some purposeless movement that startles the soldiers and kicks off the slaughter. That's not how this ends. It can't be. If they die, Fry will take Rosie. Stephen will spill everything he knows about the cure. He won't be able to stop himself. And her baby will be picked apart on an autopsy slab while he's still alive. He will be the first of a great multitude. What? Fry says to the colonel. You've finally realized there's a downside to democracy. I find that hard to believe. She turns to the officer at her side. Captain Manolis, lead a detail across to the Rosalind Franklin. 6 men, including 2 engineers. Dismantle her treads so she is unable to move. The officer salutes and vanishes into the dark. I strongly advise you not to do that, the colonel says. My men on board will interpret it as a hostile act. Fry all but smirks. Your men on board? I believe you're talking about the autistic boy, Stephen Greaves, and Dr. Fournier, who answers to me and, in any case, is too much of a coward to contemplate killing himself. The brigadier shakes her head. She has seen through all of Colonel Carlyle's subterfuges, and she is expansive in her victory, but not too expansive. We can still do this without any unnecessary loss of life, she says. Tell them to come out. Do it now. Otherwise, I'll have to order the captain to block the air vents. Once they're all dead, we can burn our way in through the airlock, doing no damage to the hull at all. Carlyle takes a deep breath and holds it. He tenses, and the soldiers all around them gather themselves visibly, interpreting his involuntary movement as a sign that he is about to attack the brigadier. But he doesn't. He only looks back across the distance that separates them from Rosie. It seems immense to Khan, an unbridgeable gulf, before settling his gaze on Fry again. May I remind you of the baby? He says in a tone that is still very close to calm. Certainly, Isaac. May I remind you that I'm giving you the choice? There is a moment's silence. Fry raises her radio, watching Carlyle for a decision. Khan feels another wave of weakness, of fuzzed focus, of absence, rush through her. She finds a thought and keeps it in the forefront of her mind. If Fry starts to speak into the radio, she will stop her. Whatever it costs her, that order isn't going to be spoken. Geraldine, Carlyle says, you've made a terrible mistake. Have I? Fry inquires with icy politeness. I don't think so. But yes, Carlyle insists, blatantly playing for time, and not very much of it, seconds at most. All of this, this entire situation has been of your making. You were so sure that what humankind needed most was you, that you were prepared to kill them all to prove your point, which, by the way, you haven't. Even if you were right in the first place about Beacon needing a strong and centralized command structure, you've achieved precisely the opposite of what you intended. You've introduced chaos and randomness into a system that was barely surviving as it was. The Junkers. You know what they've done, how they live. If Beacon survives, it will be in spite of you. I imagine that will be the kindest epitaph you'll get. I beg to differ, the brigadier says. It's the conciseness of that reply, after the colonel's intentionally drawn-out j'accuse, that tells Khan the conversation is at an end. The children have failed them. They're out of time. And so is she. There is nothing left to cling to. She's going out with the tide of her own breath. She will die, and her friends will die, and Stephen, and then her baby, last of all. She looks from face to face, trying to find an anchor that will hold her fragmenting mind in this place for a few seconds longer. But every face is turned away from her. A soggy spark of realization flickers, fades, almost dies. Every face is turned. The beacon soldiers and the junkers have their guns trained on Carlisle, on Foss, on McQueen, on Sixsmith. The men and women in uniform with rifles on their backs and pistols on their belts. The clear and present dangers. They have discounted the petite Asian woman in her soiled white lab coat. She is so clearly not a concern, not a factor in any of this. She takes a half step forward. "Private," she says. Her voice is a pitiful thing, hoarse and fractured, without breath to drive it. She doesn't say it to anyone in particular, and the man who glances in her direction isn't a soldier at all. He's a junker, an alpha male with corded muscle in his arms, braids in his shoulder-length hair, and a moustache that reminds Khan of circus strongmen. The ultimate satirical statement of masculinity. His rifle still pointed at the colonel, he reaches out a hand to push her back. Khan takes the hand in both of hers, turns it so the fleshy part at the base of the thumb is clearly exposed. She might be trying to read his future. But he doesn't have one, any more than she does. She lowers her head and bites down hard. Chapter 59. If Beacon survives, the colonel tells Geraldine Fry, it will be in spite of you. I imagine that will be the kindest epitaph you'll get. Fry gives him a glare of frank contempt. I beg to differ, she says. Something in her bearing changes. It's not easy to define, but it's unmistakable. She draws back a little way. The next time she speaks, Colonel Carlisle knows beyond a doubt, it will be to tell her men to open fire. To her left, and out of her direct line of sight, Samrina Khan reaches out and takes the hand of one of the junkers guarding them. Then she bends down, as far as he can tell, to kiss it. It's such a grotesque and unexpected sight that it makes Carlisle falter, stumbling over the temporizing words he's trying to get out. So he says nothing. He just laughs, long and loud, dredging up the sound from the bottom of his chest, drawing it out, shaking his head and wiping imaginary tears from the corner of his eye. Just to buy a few extra seconds, as Fry watches the pantomime, stony-faced instead of giving the order. "Would you care to share the joke, Isaac?" she demands as he subsides. Carlisle waves a hand, as though he's still too helpless to speak. "Ready, rifles!" the brigadier raps out. She gets no further than that. The man Dr. Khan just kissed has flung himself violently upon the man beside him. Khan herself has progressed to the uniformed soldier on her other side, taking advantage of his momentary inattention to sink her teeth into his wrist. The man wrenches his hand away and raises his rifle to club her down, but before he completes the motion he freezes on the spot. The rifle slips from his grip, and his feet shuffle as though he is trying to walk, but forgetting the intricate rules. Abruptly he swivels, and charges the private behind him, engulfing her in a clumsy, tight embrace. They topple together. Meanwhile, both the junker Khan bit and the soldier he attacked have each found new partners and borne them down. "Ready, rifles!" Fry bellows again. But now the disturbance is spreading. That whole part of the line is involved in a complex wrestling match. The men Khan blessed with her laying on of hands and teeth, passing the bad news along to their nearest comrades, who in their turn. Every man and woman here has enough experience with this to know what they're seeing. This daisy chain is what they dread more than anything else in the world. It's what happens when people are exposed to the hungry pathogen. Somehow, impossibly, Khan has infected them. She is the vector of this micro-epidemic that is spreading now in waves outwards from her. There are shouts of panic. Men and women rising up from the ruck on the floor are summarily shot by those who haven't been affected yet. They haven't figured out that Khan is ground zero because she isn't flinging herself at them in the way the men she touched are. She just stands and watches the chaos she has caused through heavy-lidded eyes, as though she is suddenly exhausted. Brigadier Frive still yelling orders. They're good orders, too. Step back. Don't engage. Aim low. Isolate and incapacitate. The newly transformed Hungries drop one by one. But so do the men who are firing on them. Something whines by the colonel's ear, invisible, to smack into the skull of a junker 10 yards away. A black stone, angular and highly polished. Volcanic glass, perhaps. Northern Scotland, the colonel vaguely remembers, is rich in Mesolithic pitchstone. Whatever it is, it hits with enough force to remain embedded in the man's forehead as he falls. The feral children have arrived at last. Geraldine Fry looks from side to side, bewildered. She doesn't understand, in those first few moments, what this new threat is and where it is located. By the time she realizes, her troops are falling like wheat. She tries to rally them, yells to them to fall back to the vehicles in good order. If they were used to serving in the same command, if they knew what good order was, they might be in with a chance. The junkers break in all directions. The beacon soldiers can't even begin to hold the line that's left. An adjutant over by the Challenger turns to relay the brigadier's orders. He dies with his mouth wide open and a spear through his neck cutting off the words he was about to say. By this time, McQueen and Foss and Sixsmith have shrugged their rifles off their shoulders, have brought them around and up to the ready. They're taking aim, as far as they need to. At this distance, the Scar H is not a discriminating weapon. Firing at will, they move forward, away from Rosie and from the attacking children, through the ragged line of beacon troops and the milling junkers who are in no formation at all. Nothing stands in their way. Or at least not for long. They lay down a corridor in the chaos and walk on through it. Carlyle follows them, slower in his gait because of his limp, and more deliberate in choosing targets. He shoots junkers wherever he can, avoids the few uniforms he can see. His sympathies here are for the men and women, surely there must have been some, who thought they were fighting for something real. Breaking through the line is much easier than he had feared. The junkers have scattered, which is a quick and easy suicide. The beacon soldiers are doing what their training tells them to do, kneeling or throwing themselves prone to make a smaller target, using the towering weeds for cover. The enemy out in the night, seeing them by their body heat, kills them just the same. The remnants of Rosie's military escort break out on the far side of the cordon and leave them to it. Predators and prey can sort it out among themselves. The little group sprints into the denser undergrowth at the edge of the concrete field, Carlyle still bringing up the rear. McQueen staggers, emitting a grunt of pain and surprise. He has taken a hit to the upper body, though it's impossible in the dark to say exactly where. His rifle clatters from his grip. He draws his pistol clumsily with his left hand and keeps on moving. Finally, they put the two staff cars and the Challenger between themselves and the worst of the gunfire. The plan now is to carry on in as straight a line as they can manage until they reach the perimeter fence, and then follow it widdershins to the base's south gate where Rosie will meet them. It's a terrible plan, built on the optimistic premise that their two enemies will obligingly break against each other and leave nobody standing to pursue them. It also assumes that they will not lose each other in the dark. Unfortunately, they already have. The colonel slows, realizing suddenly that Dr. Khan is no longer with them. He turns and looks back the way they've just come, but the headlights of the parked vehicles are the only illumination, and they're all pointing at Rosie on the far side of the parade ground. Small, fleet figures race in and out of the beams. Like bats, they're almost too quick to see at all. When a burst of machine gun fire rips apart the brambles a few feet away from Carlyle, he is forced to move forward again. For another 50 yards. This time it's Sixsmith who stumbles to a halt. She points wordlessly off to the left.
No way!
Foss exclaims incredulously.
No fucking way!
The Brigadier would surely have left at least a token guard on the copter, but there is no sign of them now. Perhaps they went to join the fight. Perhaps, seeing the way things were going, they scattered and took cover. Whichever decision they went with, it will probably make no difference to their eventual fate. The copter is a crude, functional thing, a bulbous egg at the end of a fuselage that's no more than a single steel strut. What is this piece of shit? McQueen grunts in disgust. He is bent over like an old man, his right arm folded against his chest. Wherever he was hit, Carlyle does not believe it's a flesh wound. MH6, Sixsmith mutters tersely, running past him and vaulting into the pilot seat. Little bird, I can fly this. I can fly it all the way to Beacon.
Yeah, but we can't ride it, Foss protests. There's no room.
It will take 4.
There are fucking 8 of us.
4 on the gun platform, I mean. Plus pilot and co-pilot. Khan can hold her baby and the civilian commander can fucking walk home.
Works for me, McQueen says.
He moves forward, but he doesn't seem able to raise his foot high enough to climb into the copter's rear. Foss has to lift and manhandle him in, which is a struggle. Then she clambers in after him. Carlyle hesitates, looking back once more toward the parade ground, where bursts of gunfire and screams of despair can still be heard, but at lengthening intervals. He leaves it too long, and he lets his guard down, like a fool, thinking that the danger has stayed where it was put. Something cold touches his temple.
You bastard!
Fry hisses into his ear.
This was about our future. You've stolen our future.
Her fingers feel down his arm, find his pistol and tug it from his hand. He hears the heavy thud as it falls into the weeds. McQueen and Foss are inside the copter's passenger space and haven't realized what's happening. Sixsmith sees, but she has set her rifle down in the co-pilot's seat to get to grips with the copter's controls. She glances across at it now, but there is no way she can get anywhere near it before Fry fires.
You did that, Geraldine, Carlyle says, when you started this. Nobody forced your hand.
I want Beacon to survive. That's what forced my hand. Tell your people to get out of my copter.
No.
Tell them, Isaac. Now.
No.
Fine.
Subconsciously, he expects to hear the click of the safety, but why would the safety be on in the middle of a massacre? What he hears is the ringing, echoing roar of the Brigadier's pistol discharging right beside his ear. The shot goes wide, though the range was point blank. Fry's legs buckle under her, and she folds backwards, her arms windmilling. Samrina Khan's jaws are locked in her throat. They hit the ground together. Carlyle kneels quickly and gropes in the long grass for his pistol. Khan is on her knees too, her upper body leaning over the Brigadier's and mostly hiding it from sight. The sounds, though, signal clearly that what is being hidden is extreme and cannibalistic in nature. Carlyle finds the gun in the same moment that Samrina raises her head. The blood is black in the dim light, smeared across the lower half of the doctor's face like a highwayman's mask. Even her teeth are black, so her gaping mouth is just a tunnel. Sixsmith has grabbed her rifle now. She hugs it to her chest like a comforter. But Foss jumps down from the rear platform with her weapon raised and ready.
Then she sees who it is that's crouching on her haunches in the grass.
Oh, shit,
she whispers. Carlyle goes down on one knee, his stiff leg protesting at the harsh usage. Samrina, he says, you have to get into the copter. Do you understand me?
Sir,
Foss protests. Now, Samrina, quickly.
Sir, you can bloody well see she's turned.
Isaac, Khan croaks. The word is barely audible. Yes, Samrina, into the copter, now. Khan raises her hand. The movement is jerky and effortful, stitched together out of a dozen separate acts of new willpower. She touches her extended fingertip to the center of her forehead.
Don't look back, she says,
distinctly. Her eyes lose focus, as though she's peering with difficulty through the disordered drifts of memory into another time and place. Her lips are still moving, but she has run out of words. It doesn't matter. There is no mistaking her meaning.
Colonel, please, get out of my way and give me a clear shot.
Khan exhales, a long, breathy sibilance. She gathers herself, her upper body ducking a little as she compacts the muscles of her legs and arms, hands splayed wide, jaws gaping. In the instant before she leaps, Carlyle places his pistol against her forehead, exactly in the spot she indicated, and pulls the trigger. Takes what was left of Samrina Khan, and paints the grass and concrete with it. The aborted attack carries her into his arms. He drops the pistol again to catch her, her insubstantial weight not even making him stagger. He lowers her to the ground with excessive care. He is not crying. He makes no sound. The grief is wedged so deep within him that he can't turn it into breath. Sixsmith is examining the brigadier's body. After a moment of wary circling, she lowers her rifle. Most of Fry's throat and upper chest are gone, so there is nothing to be afraid of there. She turns her attention to Dr. Khan, who is even more indubitably dead. What a waste, she mutters. She struggles for words, comes up with nothing better. What a fucking waste. She saved us all from dying back there, Carlyle snaps. And everyone on Rosie, too. That's not waste. Don't ever call that waste. Lieutenant Foss leans down to help him to his feet, but he stands unaided, though the pain forces a gasp out of him. Sir, we've got to get out of here, Foss says. The words make sense, and he is about to follow her, but he makes the mistake of looking over his shoulder. He stays where he is, unmoving.
Sir?
Rosie, the Colonel exclaims. It's the best he can manage.
We'll rendezvous with Rosie at the South Gate, as per plan, Foss says.
But then she follows his gaze and sees what he has seen. Rosie isn't moving, and she is surrounded. Not by Captain Manolis and his detail, or by the Junker warriors. The diminutive figures clustered around her front and her sides can only be the feral children. And the fact that they have come out of hiding presumably means that Fry's people are all dead or in the wind. With an obscene oath, Foss takes aim. The Colonel grabs hold of the Scar H's barrel and forces it down. The midsection door has just slid open. Stephen Greaves emerges from the airlock and steps down into the midst of the children. He is holding Samrina Khan's baby in his arms. "Listen to me, Lieutenant," Carlyle snaps. He tells Foss what Khan told him in Rosie's airlock. He doesn't have to explain to her what it means. He tells her to get the survivors back to Beacon and to spread the word to anyone they trust. Then he heads back across the parade ground, picking his way around the dead. Chapter 60. With baby Khan tucked up in Rena's bunk, surrounded by her smell and her residual presence,
Greaves watches the battle from up in the turret. He hates it, but he has to watch because he has made a promise to Rena that he means to keep. His window of opportunity, if it comes at all, will be narrow.